Welcome to the ClearAdmit MBA Admissions Podcast. I'm your host, Graham Richmond, and this special episode is a continuation of our very popular Admissions Director Q&A series. Today, I'm thrilled to welcome Blair Mannix from the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. Blair's title is Director of Admissions, and she has a rich history in higher education, working at Penn since 2008, and specifically in admissions at Wharton for nearly a decade. She has an undergraduate degree from St. Joe's and a master's in higher education management from University of Pennsylvania. Welcome, Blair.
Hey, Graham. Thank you so much for having me. This is one of my favorite things to do with you guys.
Oh, it's totally fun to get together with you and talk. And I guess I feel like I have to say out of the gate here that I'm a graduate of Wharton, and I know people who listen to the podcast sometimes give me a little bit of lip because I'm like kind of a homer for Wharton. So I was looking forward to this, to say the least.
But I have confirmed that Graham is giving me the tough questions and the same questions as everybody else. So yes,
No special treatment. All right. So the first question that we have for you is, I just want to know a little bit about your background and sort of the path that led you to your current role at Wharton.
Yeah, I love this question because I feel like I do have a pretty specific, I jokingly call it an origin story in admissions. I was 20 years old in college, working in the admissions office as an undergrad. I loved it, you know, gave tours, walked backwards, the whole thing. And then I transferred schools because of a couple family reasons. Didn't like the school I had transferred to and started making plans to come back to St. Joe's, where I had gone, you know, and graduated as an undergrad. So I ended up, after my college career, transferring schools twice. I still graduated in 4 years. That is a very important side note. But while I was doing that, Graham, the people in the admissions offices absolutely saved my life. They helped me figure out what classes to take and how to craft applications and how to write letters to get scholarship money back. And, you know, I said, these people have really helped me. Like, I would love to help others and kind of pay this forward. I had always been an outgoing public speaker, pretty energetic and really liked to communicate. And I saw the admissions folks I worked with do that as well. And so I thought it would be a really good pathway for me. In fact, when I was interviewing at the University of Pennsylvania, I actually got there in 2006. So I was interviewing in 2005 and somebody asked me, they said, what are you gonna be doing in 5 years? And I said, this, I'll be doing this. And I am. It's been 15 years and I've been doing this. So I feel very fortunate. It's been such a wild, lovely, beautiful ride. I've been at Penn since I graduated in 2006. I spent the first 6 years of my career in undergraduate admissions. So many folks, I actually admitted to the undergrad program at Penn, and then if they reapply to the MBA, sometimes I will recognize the names. And we just admit them one more time, so I get them twice. And then came to Wharton in 2012. Specifically, I have a background in the philosophy and ideology of application reading. Internally, we call it evaluation and selection, and I've doubled down on that for probably 10 years of the 15 years of my career, the ins and outs of reader training and how we read applications, why we read them, and then all the data that goes into admitting, waitlisting, and unfortunately denying. And I've been doing that for the bulk of my career until I was lucky enough to be put into the director's chair in 2018.
Wow. Yeah, it's been a great journey. And I apologize for getting the dates a little bit off there. So you've been there even...
Do not think twice.
Even longer, which is great. So I guess you're totally well-equipped to answer this next question then, which is, what do you like about working in admissions? And also, what do you dislike?
So it's... You know, I say this publicly all the time, the Wharton family, and you know this, right, being a member, the Wharton family is a really special family. Wharton is a really special place. It's really, what gets me out of bed every morning is the culture, it's the team, it's my team. Our admissions committee are some of the smartest people that I've ever had the privilege of being in one room with. And then I'll, you know, jump off of that a little and say, I absolutely, you know, love never being the smartest person in the room. You know, we bring in professors and professionals and data scientists and just these really crazy people to help us do the work that we do, you know, every month as we go through our cycle. And it's such a privilege. And I'm never the smartest person in a room. And if you are, you're probably in the wrong room, which we've heard that quote many times. And that's what I like about working at Wharton.
And what about, is there something that you don't like doing?
Yeah, I've reflected on this. I'm a pretty glass half full girl, but I was like, let me give you the real answer. So one of my life mottos is ask for forgiveness and not permission. You know who doesn't like that? Human resources. Human resources does not like that. So that is difficult for me, navigating policies, procedures, and paperwork, the three Ps. Very difficult for a woman that likes forgiveness and not permission. So that has been a challenge in my managerial growth.
It's funny because my first boss out of college used to always say, oh, it's easier to seek forgiveness than permission. And I always was kind of struck by that. And he would do like, you know, amazing things. He was an entrepreneur. He'd launched like a whole bunch of companies and yeah. So
right.
Real creative thinker, et cetera. And I get that. I think a lot of people don't, there's often a lot of red tape that makes it harder to like just get something done.
Right.
So I totally get that.
Well, that's been my motto for basically not just my entire professional life. We'll go back to like even my early life. Ask for forgiveness and not permission, but does not work in all circumstances for anybody listening.
Yes, agreed. Let's get into, you know, you talked about Wharton being a really special kind of family. I want you to give me like, give me a stereotype about Wharton that you want to debunk, because I feel like there are a lot of them out there.
Yeah, there's a lot. And this one's not going to be surprising, but I do want to take the opportunity to just unpack it a little bit. You know, the word cutthroat, the idea that our students are really cutthroat, kind of like always gets me. You know, people don't think they help each other on interview prep. They do. People don't think they run cases together for consulting interviews. They do. People don't think there's study groups. There are. As you know very well, we have grade non-disclosure. And so that helps the culture too. You're not fighting and jostling for a curve. You know, we want you to take classes that we think you'll excel in, or things you just really need to learn. So like this idea of a cutthroat, I'm going to say student, but then I'll actually extrapolate that out to faculty and staff. Like, is this pervasive stereotype? Also, I think we get this reputation for being very formal, very buttoned up, very Wharton. And I certainly fell victim to that. And I had been on campus. I had been on campus for 6 years in just a building 2 blocks down the road. And I thought Wharton was a specific thing. And then you meet the people and you realize that we are not, you know, stuffy or buttoned up. We're just real people trying to do, you know, real world good in the business space. And I hope to be kind of like the face of that. You know, a lot of people meet me and they're like, well, you're the first person I've met from the Wharton family, and you're not what I thought you would be like. And I take that as a compliment. But I will say lastly, whenever people say, oh, you know, admissions, like I came to one of your events or I was on campus, and it absolutely debunked the stereotypes I had about a Wharton student. A lot of people get excited about that, but I actually get sad because it means that we're not doing our job well enough. So I just am working really hard to debunk those stereotypes that we're not cutthroat. We are human beings. We're not buttoned up. We're real. And anybody will see that when they get to campus.
Yeah, I mean, I can attest that as someone who came from kind of a qualitative background as an undergrad, I was so reliant on classmates to sort of help me with some of the, you know, classes that I'd had zero exposure to before showing up. And people were like incredibly giving of their time and their kind of expertise and grade non-disclosure, like you said, like we didn't have, you just pass fail. It was super collaborative, the learning teams. I was blown away. And I think that maybe some of it is that I feel like at Wharton, there was always this emphasis on, you know, you're not just going to be like a senior manager who just kind of, you know, observes the factory floor from some high, you know, from a window up above or something, but you need to be able to understand and kind of roll up your sleeves. And so I loved that aspect of like really, you know, needing to understand operations and finance and everything so that if you did sit down with the people on your team who are doing those things, you could dive right in with them and understand it fully. So I love that approach. And
yeah,
I totally agree. Not cutthroat at all, but it is, for some reason, it's like this stereotype that's out there. So great to hear you kind of speak to that one. Let's shift gears. I want to know about something new that's happening or maybe that's going to be happening on campus that you wish kind of more people knew about.
Yeah, great question. So, you know, my quick hit answers are two new academic buildings on campus, including a huge entrepreneurship center called Tangen Hall. But that's actually not my real answer. The real answer I wanted to talk about is, if I could have three answers, is Dean James, our dean. I'm going to still classify her as new. She is just celebrating her one-year anniversary as the first female woman of color dean of a major business institution. And you know, we're excited about that, obviously. And I also say that, you know, she's a year in, but we're just getting to meet her in person over the next 6 to 8 weeks because we're coming back to campus. So it's not super new, but it kind of feels exciting and new. And I just want, you know, if given the opportunity, like, it has been such a beautiful pleasure to work with her and for her. You know, anything and everything that people have been saying about her in the press is absolutely true. Like, you know, I get off calls with her and people will say, like, what is she like? I'm like, she really is kind of that visionary leader, you know, compassionate. Just, I would say a month ago, I was reading an interesting article, and I can't remember where, about female leadership in the life and times of the pandemic. Yeah. And maybe that this is our time, because empathetic, compassionate leadership that not always, but so often can come from women is really going to be the hallmark for companies, corporations, and organizations kind of moving through this pandemic. And I have a post-it note on my desk that just basically said, like, this is our time, because I think that women in leadership are really going to turn a corner in this pandemic and coming out of it. And she has absolutely been, I think, in my opinion, the face of that, at least for us.
Yeah, I've been watching from afar, you know, via LinkedIn and other places where she's, you know, obviously taken to the internet to kind of meet alumni and also just to kind of message about the school. And I've been really impressed. And I think I felt bad that, you know, she started in this like maelstrom of the of the pandemic and everything. But I think, I was shocked to see a post from her the other day about how it'd been 1 year. I was like, wow, already? It feels like, you know, she just started, because everything's been like in a weird time warp with, you know, people being stuck at home and stuff. So it sounds like she's doing really well and is making great impressions. So hopefully I'll get to meet her at some point when I'm on campus or something. We shall see. Tell me a little bit about this. A lot of our listeners, as you know, are they're applying to business school. They're already in the throes of, like, they've made their list of schools and they're beginning to work on applications. And so I think one of the things that's really useful for them to hear about is just sort of the life cycle of an application. They know they're going to put a ton of effort into, you know, filling out essays and forms and everything and getting it in. But then it's sort of like a black box and they don't know what happens. So if you could sort of take us through what happens from the moment someone hits submit to the moment that they get accepted, just kind of in broad brushstrokes, like what happens to the file, and just so that everyone has an understanding of that.
Of course. Well, I love this question, Graham. And, you know, let me just say off the top that providing transparent applicant information is really one of the bedrock principles that I kind of sit in this role with, kind of trying to democratize that information, trying to give, you know, those app tips to students as they walk through this application, because we really don't want students to be the level of stressed out they are about these applications. So from the second I took the chair 3 years ago, one of the things I'm most proud of is that we launched the first application tip sessions of any of the schools. We did them every other week in the summer leading up. I think it was summer 18 into summer 18. And we still do these. So I would say anybody listening to this, if you want me or one of my staff to do a point by point from the first drop down of which major you need to apply to, kind of through crafting essays and letters and the team-based discussion, like, all of that information is there and available to you on our website. It's also on our YouTube channel. I did a webinar that I got a ton of good feedback on, and you can fast forward me to different topics so you don't have to watch me for an hour. I'll do like a whole, you know, a 10-minute bit on letters and a 10-minute bit on essays. So all that information is available. So I digress, but kind of that overarching ideology of transparency and democratizing the information is something I feel really passionate about. So thanks for allowing me to kind of get that out there. But in terms of the life of an application, so first of all, ideologically, and I say this all the time, Graham, I know you've heard me say this many times, but the overall philosophy we have is one I call read to admit. So that means any piece of applicant material in your entire application, once you submit it, I want anybody listening to this to know and understand that the people that are reading it are reading your application to admit, which means they're looking for your best days and not your worst days. So I'll just say ideologically at the top, that's how everything is looked at. Secondarily, under that, our entire process is built to reduce both reader bias and noise in decisioning. There's a great book that literally just came out about 6 weeks ago, Danny Kahneman. I don't know if you, I mean, maybe you haven't read it. It's like right in my wheelhouse. It's literally called Noise. And it's about noise in decision making, from hiring to there's admissions, you know, chapter in there to military stuff. It's just like there is a lot of noise in decision making. How can we build a process that reduces bias and reduces noise from the get-go? Okay, so I say that. Your application gets submitted. It is immediately read by two different application readers in a blind context, meaning that application reader number one has no idea what application reader number two thought of the components of your application. Mm-hmm. And that is really important because all academic research says if you have one person evaluate a candidacy, either for admission to a school or a job or the military, any application evaluator for school, job, military, after the initial application read will be so anchored to the original read, you will never get a different opinion on your candidacy for the job or for admission or for the military, etc. So ours are blind because we want at least two different viewpoints on your candidacy. And candidates, they probably don't think about this, but they want that.
Yeah.
They want that because what if, and I, you know, say it's deep within my soul, I've been doing this my entire career, but say deep within my soul, I have a bias for or against, I don't know, I'm making this up, mechanical engineers, or mm-hmm. I have a bias for or against people that went to Big Ten schools. Mm-hmm. You know, we don't want my weird internal bias dictating that decision, right? So my decision will have just as much weight as somebody else's decision that maybe has a bias towards Big Ten schools or whatever, right? So I think that's important. Blind reads, reduce bias and noise, that's the bedrock of our process. Second thing I think is important to understand is that we actually look at every single application in a committee setting before we release interviews. Now, I haven't worked in any other business school admissions offices, but I know that a lot of people don't have the time or the resources to look at everybody in the aggregate before releasing admissions interview decisions. So everybody gets read, and then we look at the entirety of the pool to start crafting the class at the interview stage. My line to the staff those days that are really long trying to craft those interview classes, as I call them, is if we don't get it right now, we don't get the opportunity to get it right later,
right.
Which is very true. So to me, the interview release is actually, and I'll just, you know, be very open, is the most stressful times in my calendar, because if I don't get it right, I don't get the opportunity to get it right later. Mm-hmm. So then we launch our interviews. We interview less than 50% of everybody that applies per round. It vary, you know, it oscillates between interview rates between rounds and obviously between years, depending on the cycle and the pool. Then everybody is launched into the team-based discussion. And I know there's a question coming up about the team-based discussion, so I will leave that to go in a little bit more depth. But I'll just say that we feel really strongly in observable, visible behaviors, and that's what the team-based discussion tracks. Everybody gets the same prompt. You have plenty of time to prepare. It's difficult to prepare, but the reason we like it is because you can't game the system. Introverts do just as well as extroverts, and it's not subject to as much personal bias and noise as behavioral interviews or other types of interviews. After that, we get the results of those team-based discussion interviews back. The applications are read again, and then we sit in committee and we'll make decisions as a committee. We do have an admissions committee of seven, but we do bring in other experts from around the division to make sure that we're making the correct decisions in each individual place. And then we release all the decisions together on the day that we said we would, when we announced the calendars in May. One of my favorite compliments I've ever gotten, and nobody would ever think this, but it might have even been on the Clear Admit site, Graham, but it said, Wharton releases their decisions the day they said they would, in the hour they said they would, and they never waver.
Yes.
And that is how I feel about that. Yeah, that is true. I never waver. If I tell you they're going to be out December 17th at noon, they will be out December 17th at noon. So that is something I'm proud of. And that's how it works a little bit.
And the reason people were remarking on that, I think it was on a LiveWire post or something, is because not many schools adhere to, or, you know,
right.
There's sort of ambiguity. And I know of a school that, you know, people were waiting for decisions to come, and they came out, but they came out at like midnight on the day that they were supposed to come out. And most people had assumed, oh, they're going to come out at noon or 5 p.m. or something. And so,
right.
Yeah, sometimes schools don't adhere, and you guys are always really good about that. I think it's also really interesting to hear that you are in committee discussing these candidacies for interview, which is great. And I think you're right that, I know a little bit about how other offices function, and I cannot think of many where they actually take the time to do it for all. It's just too cumbersome, right? So I think it's really interesting that you guys make the time to do that. Just to clarify, so it sounds like everyone gets roughly 3 reads of their file, with the third read coming after the interview process is complete.
Yep.
One of the things that I just want to draw a kind of fine line under, because people always ask about it, is when you do that final read, it's not based purely on the interview or the team-based discussion. It's sort of a holistic review again, right, at the end.
Yes. Well, thank you for asking that. Yes, that's a very important point. And I say this a lot, but this is something that I think I want people to know. Not I think. This is something I want people to know, and I feel really strongly in this. Interviews at Wharton, it's not like you've hit you've surpassed the application threshold, you get invited to interview, you either do well and you're admitted, or you do poorly and you're denied.
Right.
I say consistently that the sum of who you are in the 1 hour or so that we're interviewing you is not equivalent to who you've been for the last 7 years of your career and struggling for the A in organic chemistry as an undergrad. And certainly struggling for the A in undergrad physics at MIT is not the same as the result of who you are in your humanity for 1 hour in February of 2020, right?
Right.
And we love, this is something I love the most about Wharton, is that the leadership at Wharton has given us, myself and the rest of the team, the clearance to say, craft a class of people that can learn from each other, right? So we're consistently admitting folks that are really strong in maybe the classroom arena and their career arena, but maybe are not, as I call them, the room runners, right? The people that know how to run a meeting and talk to people. That's a skill that Wharton will teach you. Conversely, we admit a lot of students that are those room runners, right? That know how to talk to people, that know how to get things done, that know how to bring people into conversations, but maybe didn't get an A in physics. Both of those people we want. And I'll just say, like, human brains in decision-making capacity, and this is for employment, and this is certainly for admissions, if you don't say it at the top, that kind of a bedrock of your decisioning, because we won't call it admitting, we'll just call it like decisioning. If the bedrock of your decisioning is not that you need to separate those two skills, then your brain actually can't separate those skills. Like, unless you drill it into the folks that are making these decisions, that you don't have to be perfect in every arena in order to be admitted or unable to be employed. And that's something we drill on a lot. We drill on biases, we drill on kind of like cognitive load, because it's cognitive load to make all these decisions. And we work really hard to make sure that we don't get decision fatigue and we're not overloaded cognitively and we're making the correct decisions for every single human that comes through.
Yeah, that's great to hear. So while we're talking about kind of the application process, I know that candidates like to, really focus in on essays. And so is there any kind of general tip you want to give with respect to the application essays? Like, what would you say to someone who's kind of just sitting down to write these essays?
Yeah. Oh, it's so hard because essay writing is so personal. And, I've told this anecdote before, but my sister applied to a graduate program at Penn, not the MBA. That would be weird. And I was on the phone with her. This was years ago, maybe 2-3 years ago. And she's so passionate about this degree, Graham, and she knows exactly what she wants from it. And she's read every literature in the space, and she's read all the, she's listened to all the podcasts, and she's so into it. And she spent 10 minutes detailing to me, I want to get this degree for this reason. And I listened to this author, and he kicked me into this, type of work in the space that I didn't know was a thing. And then I went down that rabbit hole. And what I want to do is use this to pivot from consulting to, and then she ends her whole story and says, well, what should I write about? And I I said, you should write that. You should write the 10-minute story you just told me because it's real. It's from your heart and it's real. Like, it's real. That's why you want to come get this degree. So I say that as just kind of a piece of advice. Because if it's real, then it's going to make a good essay, right? But I think that's kind of like a cop-out answer, because I don't always love the answer when people are like, just be authentic, because what the heck does that really even mean? So I will say, oh, sorry, go.
No, I was going to say, I think it's fair though, because you do, there's a lot of advice out there where there's sort of people are telling candidates, oh, you've got to tell like an amazing, you know, you have to be Hemingway to get into business school or something, which is not true
no.
at all, right? So,
right.
But what were you going to say? You're going to give another tip.
Yeah, no, one of the things I like about that regarding Hemingway is I saw it, to be honest, it might've been a meme online, but it was something like, in college, colon, you know, you turn in a 7-page political science paper and the professor comes back and says, make it 3 more pages. And then it like cut to real life and you have a slide with 7 bullets on it. And the boss says, 7 bullets is too many, 3 bullets max, right? So it's like, right. we're being trained, you know, despite your undergraduate major or whatever, to like write 15-page papers. Yet in the real world, in the business world, 7 bullet points is too much. So,
right.
I will say this, you know, our essays have a word limit. You actually, when we were speaking earlier, we were kind of riffing on something and you used the word tight. You were like, and that word kind of like resonated with me about essays. It's like if you want to use 3 to 5 words, or say you want to use 5 words in your essay, use 3. Just kind of drill on it that you're trying to get your point across tightly, because I think that's a precursor for success in the business world, not in all fields for sure, but in many. And being able to get yourself across in less words, I think, has been valuable to candidates, because it really focuses them on what they want out of this degree. And then it's helpful for us because you're not waxing poetically. I mean, you mentioned anyway, but you're not waxing poetically about, you know, some aspects of the program. You're saying directly, I'm here in this applicant pool, I'm putting in my time because I want to do this and I hope to get out of it this, and it's being very direct and open, and that's who I am, that's who our admissions committee is, and that's the advice I like to give.
Yeah, that's great advice. I would say, I did want to ask you about something, and I recognize, you know, for applicants who are listening and are going to apply to Wharton, they don't care what the essays were last year, but I have to comment that
of
I
course.
Noticed that there was like a subtle shift between last year's career, kind of career goals essay, and this year's career goals essay.
Yep.
Do you want to talk about, I mean, this year it seems a little bit tighter. I think that's the language that I actually used when I sent you a note, right?
That's where I got that word, Graham.
Yeah. And so tell me just tell me about that essay question and how you guys formulated it this year.
I love this question, because you're completely correct. I will, however, say it's really the same question. It's just written better.
Right.
And it is written better because we have the best admissions committee member on staff, who is a absolutely beautiful writer, who has a master's degree in English, and jokes that he is still paying for those words. And he is using them with aplomb. And so he wrote it, and it's just better. It's better, and it helps. We thought, you know, we talked a little bit about it, obviously internally, and we thought that it helped clarify what we were looking for. It's less ambiguous. And it's better written. So the question really isn't different. We just think it's written differently. And I hope that doesn't throw too many people off. But one of my mottos internally is like, we can always do what we do better. And I think this is better.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, it's still, I think it's obviously, it's a great essay in that it allows people to think about why they want the MBA and how they're going to, you know, what they want to get out of Wharton and, you know, how it's going to help them and stuff. And I think it's, it's very well worded this year. I totally agree. So it should be easy. Should be easy for people to kind of follow. Follow the instructions. And yeah, I'm glad that you were willing to kind of comment on that. It was just something that I had noticed. And again, I think most applicants, they don't care what the essay was last year, right? They're just focused on this year.
Right. But it's. I think it's interesting. No, it's interesting. Just you've been operating in and around the business for a long time. No, I think it's interesting. I love the question, and I will pass along the compliment to him.
All right, that sounds good. So you were correct in predicting that I was going to ask you about the team-based discussion. That's because I sent you these questions ahead of time. But I think that, let's talk about that, because it's this area of the process that is For most applicants, you know, it's something totally new, right? For almost every other school they're applying to, there's a more kind of fit interview or behavioral interview or something. And I think this is really unique to Wharton. So I'd love for you to just talk about how it works and what people should do to get ready for the team-based discussion at Wharton.
Yeah, and, you know, as I mentioned before, you know, regarding, I think it was blind interviews, I said, or excuse me, blind application reading, I think I said something like, candidates don't know, but they really want it this way. They really would prefer it this way. And the reason I say that, as I alluded to earlier, a lot of times behavioral interviews or skills-based interviews or fit interviews are just, you cannot wring bias out of them well enough. You know, you're going to be biased for or biased against. If you are reading your application, if you're reading the person's application before the interview and you're sitting down with the application, you can't become unhuman in the moment. You're going to see something that you're attracted to or something that you're attracted against, and you're going to hone in on it or avoid it, and you're going to be predisposed to like the candidate or not like the candidate when you go in. And, you know, Wharton does our research, and so it's been almost 10 years we've been running these team-based discussions. It'll be 10 years next cycle. And we just thought, you know, that is too noisy, to quote many scholars on noise, but it's too noisy. Who are we as an institution? We're a team-based learning environment. How can we assess that? A team-based discussion. It's actually called a leaderless group discussion in the academic literature. So that's what we built in 2012. And the reason we like it is because it's not, oh, that applicant made me feel great. He or she knows how to talk to people and they answered that question well. It is charting actual, visible, and observable behaviors. That way there's no ambiguity, Graham. Like, did you do this behavior? Yes or no? As opposed to, did you give me a good feeling with this question? Yes or no? It really advantages candidates from all types of walks of life, introvert, extrovert, international, domestic, foreign, foreign language speakers, English language speakers. It really democratizes the playing field because it's like, was it observable? And that's why we like it. Again, we're trying to reduce bias and noise any place we can. So this is the thing. We run this because we believe in it, but we also understand that it does create a little bit of anxiety. I know you have a lot of listeners who are going to listen to this, and my only hope is that what I just described in the fact that the outcome of this is way more advantageous to students will hopefully try to counteract the nerves. So that's the first thing. Second thing I'm going to do to counteract the nerves is this. We are not trying to make your life more difficult. We give you the prompt ahead of time, and you have 2 weeks to prep for it. We're only asking for a 1 minute response to the prompt. So you have 2 weeks to basically prepare 1 minute. Yeah. We make everything democratized. So maybe you're listening to this and you're like, they're gonna ask me about finance, but I work in energy. We're not gonna ask you about finance. We ask a very democratized question so people from all backgrounds and all walks of life can answer it. It's typically something Wharton related because it's really not about the question. It's about how you work in teams. So just think about that when you're going into it. You will then be given about 2 weeks of time slots in order to complete the team-based discussion. I'll say it here, Graham, and I think we're going to announce it on our website in a blog soon. If not, we might have already. But Wharton is going to continue to do team-based discussion interviews virtually throughout the entirety of the 2001-2002 admission cycle. And the reason we're going to is that we've actually had some wins in terms of doing them virtually. I'll say also, we've always done them virtually ever since the launch in 2012. And fun fact, we've always used Zoom. So we were like Zoom beta users in 2012, and we got a great discount when the world opened up on Zoom because we were such early adopters. It was actually a very funny conversation. So we've been doing this for a long time, not new for us, but a couple of things happened going into all virtual interviews. The groups got more randomized because we weren't flying to Tokyo. You know, everybody in Tokyo comes to the hub in Tokyo. Right. The groups were much more diverse. The conversations got better because of the diversity of opinions around the table, and everybody did better. It was such an interesting data dive, right? And so, secondarily, of course, we love that people don't have to travel. I think you know, my decision on this was mine alone. And it was really because, you know, the world is opening up. Yes, of course, but not that much. And this is, you know, a little ridiculous to be opening up interviews, even thinking about February 2022. So we're just going to do the whole thing online. But, you know, besides safety, we did have some wins for candidates in there as well. So that is exciting. And then, as I mentioned before, you know, we use these in context with the rest of the application. It's not like you do well and you get in, or you do poorly and you're denied. It really is back into like the composite of your file.
Yeah, that's all really good advice. And I think that I'm glad to hear that you're doing them virtually for the entirety of the season, because I recognize that, you know, you could say, oh, now things are opening up, let's do them in person. And then suddenly we might have, you know, another kind of confinement or whatever. And so I think to be consistent, it's great.
Right.
And I totally agree. I remember hearing at some point someone saying that when they were done in person, like you're saying, you know, you guys would go to key hubs, and invariably the people in those hub markets are from that market. And so you might have the occasional expat working in Singapore, but maybe most of the people there are from the area or something. So it just, I think it's great. And it sounds like you're really able to kind of make the groups more like the learning teams at Wharton, which is exactly what I think of whenever I hear about this exercise. Which is, you know, I think most of our listeners know that you travel through the first year at Wharton with this group of five or six classmates that are on your learning team, and you do all your homework together and lots of assignments and things. And I just remember that being a really enriching experience for me. And I don't know who is the guru behind crafting those teams, but my team was like just perfect in the sense that, you know, we had just somebody like from every possible, you know, international, there were male, female, different industries. I mean, it was just a really great mix. And I know that's done on purpose. So,
well, that is absolutely not my job, but I will also pass along that compliment. But, you know, one stereotype that I wish to not debunk is Wharton is a data place. Everything obviously is driven in data. It's 2021. How could it not be? But you just mentioned the learning teams. Yeah. We actually run the scores against the learning team outcome scores, and there the team-based discussion scores are predictive of success within your learning teams. And that's what we wanted.
Yes.
That's what we wanted 10 years ago, right? That was the goal. Like, can we drive a process that is predictive of how you're going to act in your learning team? And now 10 years later, we can say, yeah, the answer is yes, we can.
Awesome. Yeah. So I want to shift gears a little bit. I know that some of the folks listening are undergrads who are dreaming of someday, you know, setting foot on Wharton's campus as an MBA student. And so, like, do you have any advice for advanced access candidates? And, like, who should be focusing on that deferred path to an MBA versus, you know, the sort of more traditional path?
Right. That's such a good question, but also a really tough one, right? Because just like the essay is very personal.
Yeah.
As I mentioned, my background in undergraduate admissions, and I'll say kind of my 6 years in undergraduate admissions really come flooding back to my memory whenever we're evaluating the talent for the Advanced Access Program. And obviously they're at, you know, 4 year separation between their moment in time, but this is the reason. I remember evaluating applications for 18-year-olds coming to the University of Pennsylvania, and what they knew about life and how they sought to craft their destiny and the things that they knew about and how they wrote about those things. I was just so impressed with coming out of mouths and pens and computers of 18-year-olds. And I continue to feel that way. So I mention that because one of the goals for the program is to make sure that the vast, vast, vast market of students from state schools, public schools, private schools, small schools, big schools, liberal arts schools, STEM schools, research universities all know about this program. Because to me, it's, you know, thinking about that 18-year-old who has access to the type of information that they would need to apply to the University of Pennsylvania as an 18-year-old, I want to make sure that the idea and access to the information that you can apply to the Wharton MBA as a 20-year-old, as a 21-year-old, is made available to everybody. So I'll just say, like, that's our main goal, is to make sure that folks know about this program from high and low, from east and west, from north to south. So that's what we're spending a lot of our time doing, kind of evangelizing the program. So our hope is that once we get this idea out to folks that have never even thought about business school, you know, we can start to get folks, you know, kind of in that funnel into the program. To get to your second question, who should be focusing on this? My answer is that I want everybody to be focusing on this, because I really do feel passionately about the MBA, graduate management education as a whole, as being kind of like a rocket ship to the rest of your life. And if I had known, Graham, that I could, you know, apply to a big MBA program like this as a young 21-year-old woman, like, I think, I mean, hopefully I would have ended up right here, right? Because I'm very happy with my life. But who knows, you know, like what doors would have been open to me, right? So that's our hope. But I will say this, like, if anybody listening is thinking about the deferred enrollment program, the MOLIS Advanced Access Program, we're really excited about it. We are trying to make sure that you guys gain admission so you can spend the next 2 to 4 years of your career taking risks and making mistakes, right? Like, that's one of the goals. A lot of folks, we've got a lot of feedback. This is not uncommon across other schools as well. So I will not say that we're the only school that's saying this, but a lot of folks think they have to get on the banking or the consulting track to be eligible for a Wharton MBA. First of all, that's not close to true, but, you know, I can't dispel that myth everywhere, right? So we want these students to get in, gain admission, and then make some mistakes. But I also want to get the message across that we take very, very seriously, and I'll actually credit the director of the program for this completely. He had a vision for this before I did, which was, you're going to apply to this program, and, you know, they are selective programs, just like, you know, coming in kind of the regular intake. And we can't admit everybody that's qualified, which is very, very true. We take so seriously the applicants that we reject that we actually run information sessions for them, because we want to make sure that they know. So anybody listening to this, I want anybody who applies through this intake, the Advanced Access Program, to know that if you do not get in, we really want you to apply again. It doesn't mean that you actually are not qualified for the Wharton MBA or that you won't be. It's that, like, we have a selective program. You know, it just, unfortunately, we sometimes have to make admissions decisions that don't feel great for us, given the, you know, the size of our program. Right. But please stay engaged. Please stay with us. And we would love to seriously, seriously look at your candidacy in another 3 to 4 years.
Okay. Yeah, that's excellent advice. I think that, so we're almost to the end of our regular questions, but I have to ask about COVID and kind of plans for, you know, will things be in person this fall for incoming students? And also, do you guys anticipate allowing for campus visits at any point in the coming academic, you know, year or admissions cycle? Is that stuff been decided? Is it sort of touch and go?
Right. My first kind of like gut response to this question, Graham, was, we're back, baby. Like, we're back. Plans for in-person instruction, we're back. But then I'm like, asterisk, no campus visit program.
Okay.
We're not running the campus visit program. It's at least for the fall. No decision has been made for the spring. And the reason is because we're all just coming back on the 7th of September, and I did not feel comfortable inviting the world into our offices, you know, 4 days after we get back to campus. We need a little time to adjust. So not in the fall, but we will be making an announcement dependent on Delta variant, other variants, life, lockdowns, et cetera, for the spring of 2022.
Okay. Yeah. And that sounds consistent with everyone else I've been talking to at other schools. So you're not alone there. Yeah. Everyone kind of wants to get back.
I'm like, we're back, except for this one thing.
Yeah. But that's normal. And I think candidates are really used to doing a lot of research online. So it's not the end of the world. Although I do love the campus at Wharton. So, so if you'll bear with me, I have a handful of what we call lightning round questions for you, just to let our listeners kind of get to know Blair a little bit.
That's kind.
We'll just do them rapid fire, and yeah, you can just kind of shoot off whatever answers pop to mind. So the first one is really simple: coffee or tea?
Coffee, iced, and the size of my head.
Okay. Beach or mountains?
Beach.
Okay. Yeah, you were, before we started recording, you were telling about summer plans to go to the beach. So I had to figure this was going to be beach.
Yes.
All right. Are you a morning person or a night owl?
1000% a morning person. I have a 2-year-old daughter, and if we both are not in bed by 8 p.m., I get very upset. So not only am I a morning person, but I go to bed like I'm 92 years old.
Okay. Got it. What's a pet peeve that you have?
Bad parallel parkers. I am the best parallel parker in the city of Philadelphia, and I get very upset if people don't match me.
Yes, it's funny, here in Paris, like parallel parking is a true art because, I guess if you wanted to find art is like you actually touch the car in front of you and behind you to make room kind of thing. But it is painful sometimes to watch and you almost want to like get out of your car and say, hey, do you mind if I just park your car for you so we can all can keep driving? Because it's just, you know, some people go back and forth. All right. What's a guilty pleasure?
Oh, that was a tough one. I love, this is maybe a very personal, but I love a good foot massage. I became addicted to foot massages while traveling internationally for Wharton for the last 10 years, and I always put it on my itinerary during an interview week or a week of recruitment sessions to work in a foot massage or two on the road.
Excellent. What's your favorite virtue in others?
I would say realness. You know, we were talking about this before, but I don't love being in conversations with folks that I think they're hiding something from me or holding something back. Like, I just really value humans being humans with other humans. And so I try to do that with work and obviously in my personal life, but that's something I value in others.
Okay, that makes sense. What's your happy place?
This summer, I'll say it is the pool. We just moved and joined a pool with my 2-year-old, jumping in, and then eating French fries when we get out.
That's actually that like sort of maybe dovetails with the next question, which is what's your favorite comfort food?
Yeah, we'll go with French fries. That seems like a consistent through line.
All right. I thought you might be going after like a Philly kind of favorite or something, but I get it. French fries are hard to resist. What's been your proudest moment?
You know, I thought a lot about this, but I just mentioned my 2.5-year-old daughter. I'll have to say October 31st, 2018, when she was born.
Okay.
But her name is Bryn, and she is a joy.
And I cannot believe that she's born on Halloween. That's pretty awesome.
I know. Isn't that funny? I know. I didn't like it at first, and now I like it because she has a built-in parade every day at her birthday.
You can just literally tell her, hey, because it's your birthday, go to anyone's house, knock on their door, and they'll give you candy.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. I love it.
That's awesome. All right. Biggest regret?
Oh, Lord. I mean, there could be an human answer, right? Like, but I'll just be really human and say, I don't think I got in touch with, and this will come out later, I guess, like with other questions, but I didn't get in touch with my brain until I was about 25 years old. And I mentioned all of those 18-year-old applicants that I used to read at the University of Pennsylvania undergrad admissions office, and just like the quality of intellectual curiosity they had as an 18-year-old, I didn't even understand, nor did I wish for myself, because I didn't realize I didn't have it until I was about 25. So I feel like I wasted a solid chunk of time not really being in touch with my brain, but I'll say that I'm happy I got it together. So that is a regret, that I missed a little time learning and being curious and stuff like that.
Okay. What is a superpower that you wished you had?
Oh, I'm a horrible flyer. So, like, horrible. My husband makes fun of me that I'm just like really bad on a plane. And when I tell people this story, and this gets to the answer, Graham, I promise, but when I tell people that I travel a lot for this job, they say like, oh, do you like flying? And I say, no, but it's not because I'm nervous. I don't think the plane's gonna land or crash. I just don't like being in one seat for 15 hours. Like, so that's why I don't like flying. So if I had to pick a superpower, I would fly. So I didn't have to fly 15 hours to get to some of my favorite places.
All right. It's funny. I can't remember who it was. Someone I interviewed for this was saying they would love to be able to like teleport from one place to another so that they didn't have to do all the travel.
Oh. Yeah. That's a better way to think of it. Yeah, I would love to teleport.
All right. What about, is there anything you would change about how you were raised?
I have the best family. I'm the oldest of four. Big, gregarious, personable, loud dinner conversation, Irish family. The only thing I'll say is that I'm 4 years older than the closest sibling. Mm-hmm. And so I left to move to Philadelphia when I went to college at 18, and I missed a lot. And so maybe I wish that I could, they all moved to Philadelphia with me. I think that's what I would wish.
All right. Going back to speaking of leaving for college, so you've gone to undergrad and grad school, and I don't know if along the way any institution has rejected you, and if so, like, how does that, do you like think of that when you're having to reject people in your role now?
Yeah, I mean, how much time do you have? I can give you many schools that have rejected me. You know, I'll be honest, I actually did get denied from the University of Pennsylvania grad school when I first applied, and that is because I was not in touch with my brain at an earlier time in life, and then I got it together and figured it out. So yes, that is very much still with me. I do not take lightly having to say no to folks. It's one of the hardest parts of my job. Obviously, I could have answered that kind of in an earlier iteration, but that sticks with you. I don't take it lightly. This is something that folks have been dreaming about their whole lives. And that's why we do read to admit. That's why we try to get different touch points on applications to decrease biases and decrease noise. And we build the calendar so we have enough time to give everybody who applies a look, our time. We're not fatigued. We're not cognitive overload. We take breaks. We want to make sure that everybody is getting the same type of attention and care in their decision, whether it's the first one we're rendering or the 3,000th. It never leaves you.
Yeah, that makes sense. Which part, speaking of reading all these files, which part of the application process would you most like to skip if you were applying today?
It's funny. So there's two answers to this, but I will be quick. I always joke about the extracurricular portion on our application and all applications, because in the business school context, you know, I joke, I'm like, all right, listen, you're in banking, you work in New York. Like, how much time do you have for extracurricular activities? Like, if I were to apply to the MBA right now, my extracurricular activities would be watching Muppet Babies, walking my dog, and if we're lucky, brunch, right? Like there's nothing I do extracurricular aside from mothering and working. And so I always tell people that, and that's very true, right? Yeah. It's like, if you are a parent and you're not having time to volunteer at XYZ organization, like, we understand that. So I wouldn't say I would skip it, but I just wanted to put out there that, like, it's not the most important thing we look at. However, I was just last week speaking to our data scientist, who is one of my favorite people on the planet, and we found, as you can imagine, a ton of predictive power in folks who are very committed to extracurricular activities and their success at Wharton. That doesn't mean we admit on that. That doesn't mean I'm, you know, drilling into your extracurricular profiles to determine admission, but it is a very interesting outcome. Yeah. So that's something I'm thinking about.
Interesting. And then the last question that I had for you is more of a personal one. What's the best thing that you either read, watched, or listened to recently?
This one I could drone on and on about, because I'm an avid reader. I'm an Audible addict. You know, I have like three titles. I feel like I go through at least three titles a month. I'm a podcast person. If I miss the New York Times Daily, the Wall Street Journal podcast, or the NPR Up First a day, yeah. I feel totally disconnected. All three every day. I'm constantly with my headphones in, walking the dog, or commuting back and forth from school drop off for my daughter. But I'll say two books that are kind of seminal for work, which I would love everybody to read. Noise. Danny Kahneman just came out with this book called Noise, which I've already talked about, but it is like so important for the work that we do as an admissions committee and anybody that's in a decision-making role, please check that out. Mm-hmm. His earlier book, which I'm looking at and thumbing through right now, which has the annotations of a mad woman on it, Thinking Fast and Slow, his book, I think from 2011, is also really important to me. So if I had to pick two, I won't drone on about my Audible account, but those are two of my favorites.
Okay, excellent. Blair, I really appreciate you making a lot of time to chat with us. I know that you have a million things going on in terms of, you know, admitting a class and, you know, working with your team and everything. So thanks for making time to chat. It's always fun to catch up with you. But yeah, just really appreciate it.
Well, thank you. Thank you for being you. We love our partnership with Clear Admit, and I'm grateful to get to do this. So thank you very much.
Excellent. All right. So please stay tuned to the Clear Admit MBA Admissions podcast for more Admissions Director Q&As, as well as our weekly Wiretaps episodes. And as always, thanks for rating and reviewing this podcast wherever you listen.